Hey, sit down listeners. You can find us every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Hope you're having a great day wherever you are. I am your host, Jeff Nadeau. Another week, another show, another sit down, and got a big one today. We're going to talk about another huge legend in the American mob and, you know, definitely a shit starter for sure. We're going to talk today about Joe Bonanno here in just a second. As always, make sure if you enjoy the show, please give us a deserved rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening. Give us a review if you enjoy the show, or, you know, tell us what you might like to see different. Blackjack not here again. We're going to kind of have to shake out and see what's going on with Blackjack. He's got a lot going on. Obviously, I love when he can be here, but, you know, I'll hold it down either way. Yeah, we'll get after it. Not a lot going on right now in the world of the mob. As we know, though, there's never a ton of news. You know, occasionally we'll get a death or something like that. But I like to keep it short and sweet here on the show. People enjoy the content. They enjoy the biography. So I feel like, hey, we just jump right into it. As I said, though, I hope you're all having a great week. I'm having a good week. I'm getting a new car, so I'm very excited about that. Definitely and welcome change. I definitely needed it. So that's exciting. And weather's getting better. Weather's breaking a little bit, if you will. So that's great. So as always, make sure you give us a follow on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. You can also, and I urge you, if you enjoy our mafia content here on the Sit Down podcast, please go check us out on YouTube as well. Please make sure you subscribe, like the videos, comment. We've got a lot of great content going on over there as well. I try to put out a video or two each week. Some of the smaller guys, maybe we can't fit onto the show. So go check us out. Just search the Sit Down, a Mafia History podcast. I also included a link in the description of the show. So check that out. Check us on YouTube. All right, let's get into it. There's no reason to sit around here and wait. I always get people, hey, just get into the biography. And I say, you know what? Say no more. I got you. Let's get into it. Joe Bonanno on the sit down. Giuseppe Carlo Bonanno was born January 18th, 1905 in Castellammare del Golfo, which is in the island of Sicily. Now, we have talked before about Castellammare del Golfo. A lot of gangsters have come from that area. If you know anything about Stefano Magadino, the Bonaventures, Salvatore Maranzano, plenty of gangsters, Carmine Galanti, a lot of gangsters have come from the area of Castellammare del Golfo. And look, if you don't know anything about it, really on the surface, though, it is a beautiful, beautiful place. It is really on that kind of northwestern Gulf island of Sicily. Just a beautiful place, a lot of beautiful artwork and homes, and just a terrific, beautiful place, about 30 miles away from the town of Palermo. Just a picturesque, beautiful place. Interestingly enough, Joe Bonanno's father was actually very connected in the mafia, and he was actually born into mob royalty. His father, Salvatore, was a heavyweight in a clan he belonged to, and alongside his uncle and his, you know, really, you know, nuclear family, they were very connected in the mafia. This is something that he would obviously use to kind of fuel his want to be in the life. And his cousin was actually Stefano Magadino, who, as we know, was the boss for many years up in Buffalo. They were very close, at least at one point. Their relationship would obviously sour as the year goes on. But pretty much everyone, as far as males in the Bonanno family, at least in Sicily, belonged to the mafia. And if you know anything about the Sicilian clans and that sort of thing, there were a lot of connections there. In 1907, the Bonannos actually would emigrate to America. So at a very young age, Joe came over, but it wouldn't last long. By age 12, so about 10 years later, they would actually head back to Sicily. And for Joe Bonanno, that was kind of a big change because for him, he had really only known the United States. He was only two when he came over. So for him, you know, his home was America. And I don't know that he exactly wanted to be in Sicily, but that's where his parents went and that's where they would stay. But by 1924, Joe's kind of in his late teens. He decides, you know what, I'm out. He would actually say years later that he left because he was anti-fascist at that time. And as we know, with Mussolini, he was starting to crack down on the mafia and that sort of thing. So Joe Bonanno would actually board a vessel and actually go to Florida. He would be stowed away in a fishing boat, and he would arrive in at a train station in Jacksonville. At that point, he would make his way up to New York through some members of the Genovese crime family because he had connections all over the place, and he would arrive in New York. He'd actually work kind of some odd jobs around the city. He would take up some classes at a local college at one point. But for the most part, he was a new guy in a town that he once knew, but he felt like was home. And by this point in 1924, the underworld is booming. You know, Prohibition, we've talked about before on this show, it was a huge time for the mob, and it allowed the mob to really become one of the preeminent criminal organizations in America. People were making heaps and heaps and heaps of money in the illegal alcohol trade. And that's exactly what Joe Bonanno did. He would actually link up with an old pal of his back from Castellammare del Golfo, an individual called Gaspar Di Gregorio. They would open a bit of a small distillery in an apartment building that Joe had known about, and they would start making their money. And this is something we saw. We obviously talked about the life of people like Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky. They were getting involved early in bootlegging. They got involved with the right people. And to rise to the level of where guys like Lucky Luciano got to and Joe Bonanno got to, it's important that you make the connections. Now, for Lansky and Lucky Luciano, they would connect with someone like Arnold Rothstein, who, you know, you can listen to people all you want, but at the end of the day, Arnold Rothstein was one of the most rich individuals in the history of organized crime. He was right up there with George Remus as the biggest bootlegger in the history of this country. But like Luciano and slotting in with Arnold Rothstein, that's exactly what Joe Bonanno did. He would be connected and be noticed by a young leader from Brooklyn called Salvatore Maranzano. Now, he was close with Maranzano because as a young kid, he knew who he was. They were from the same town. And, you know, Sal really took an affinity towards Joe Bonanno, and he kind of became the protege of the old guy, if you will. And as we know, in the late 20s, not only was Maranzano building up his rackets, but Joe the Boss Masseria was building up his rackets. We start to see really the formation of all these different families. And remember, the Bonanno crime family was once the Maranzano crime family. And we obviously know what would happen, you know, in the late 30s. But we always are talking about, when we talk about the mafia, who are the most influential mobsters? And no one's ever going to talk about Joe Bonanno, but there is one person that's always going to be at the top of the list. And I'm always so fascinated again and again when I talk about when Lucky Luciano did what he did. He engineered the thought of, you know what, we can't continue to be under the leadership of these old fucks. We got to get them out of the way, and we're going to play them against each other. And when it came to Joe Bonanno, obviously, we know that Masseria would be killed in 1931 in April. And we know that Maranzano would be killed in September of 1931. But the question was, and this episode is about Joe Bonanno, and we have to remember, Joe Bonanno was very close to Maranzano. But I think he quickly realized that there's a lot more value in slotting in with these young guys. At the end of the day, Joe Bonanno, by the age of 26, remember, in 5-6 short years, he just arrived in America. He is now the boss of a five family in New York. And that's, I think, at the end of the day, what really greased his wheels. He knew that ultimately he was going to control a family. And for him, why not get the boss out of the way? He had an affinity to Maranzano, but Lucky Luciano was commanding. He realized that he could get these guys to play ball because at the end of the day, they were going to become very, very powerful. And at 26, Joe Bonanno is now the head of the Bonanno crime family. And everyone works under a seven boss commission. There's rules. There's things that you have to go through. There's a glorified crew, a group that handles everything. It was the way that the mob needed to be. And this is why Lucky Luciano will always be regarded as number one, capo di tutti capi, if you will. So 26, pretty incredible. It was a great year for Joe Bonanno that year. Obviously, he becomes boss, and he would also find a bride. He would marry a woman called Faye Labruzzo in 1931, and it wouldn't be too long. He would father his first son, a son called Salvatore, named after his father, and they would call him Bill. Bill Bonanno, we'll talk about him pretty in depth. He would become very involved in his father's rackets. Joe Bonanno would actually have two other children as well, including a daughter and another son called Joe Jr. So by 1931, Joe Bonanno is the boss of a family. He is married. He has a child on the way, and things are good for him. You know, remember at this time, Prohibition is ending, but there's still plenty of money out there to be made. And he was living on top of the world. Obviously, the new commission holds a lot of sway. They meet, they operate, and everything operates by consensus. And this is what needed to happen. You couldn't just have all these rival factions going at each other all the time. Violence brings police, which cuts down on the ability to earn. And none knew that more than people like Joe Bonanno, Lucky Luciano, all these guys. By the mid-30s, things are starting to change, though. And this is where Joe Bonanno, I think, really gets a leg up on the competition. As we know with Lucky Luciano, he gets arrested for the prostitution stuff with little Davey Patillo. And, you know, what Joe Bonanno realizes is he can't make the same mistakes Lucky did. While Lucky was a very influential individual, he was a complete leader, he had some deficiencies. And one of them was he was a little too public. He was photographed a lot. He was running out and about in New York. He was a playboy. And, you know, Joe Bonanno realized that being in the shadow was probably best. And that's the way a mobster should be. We've seen this over the years, whether it's Lucky Luciano, whether it's Al Capone, whether it's John Gotti, whether it's whoever. The guys that are out there in front of the cameras, you know, posing for pictures all the time, that is not how the mob operates. And we can look at the other end of it and say, well, we look at Gambino and Tony Accardo and Marcello and Tommy Lucchese and all these different guys. The reason they were able to really, for the most part, stay out of prison and die in their own beds was because they were private. It just, that's how it had to be. And Joe Bonanno realized that very quickly. He was not going to make the same mistakes as his predecessors. Now, for Joe Bonanno, the worry was really about money and keeping his family going. And what do we know about the mob? We know they're very involved with, you know, the traditional rackets, extortion, bookmaking, loan sharking, unions, things of that nature. Definitely on the low level. But Joe Bonanno was involved in a lot of legit businesses, and this is where, you know, obviously you become a high level earner and a leader. And that's exactly what he did. Because remember, he's playing on the fly as well. Remember, he wasn't really a member for very long until he became boss. So he's doing all this for the first time. He starts investing in everything from a cheese factory. He had a woman's dress factory. He had trucking companies, funeral homes, coal manufacturers. Joe Bonanno was on top of it. And he realized, stay on the radar, make money, don't make headlines.
This episode is brought to you by Samsung. Unfold the all-new Galaxy Z Fold 4 and expand your world. With Flex Mode, it stands on its own, so you're hands-free to get more done during calls. And with multi-window view, you can use up to three apps at the same time. Plus, the edge-to-edge screen allows you to fully immerse yourself in your favorite games and shows. Visit Samsung.com to learn more about Galaxy Z Fold 4.
In 1941, though, Joe Bonanno has to come to a realization. By this point, his son, Bill, is about 9 years old, and he would have some real medical problems. His son would develop an ear issue, and the doctors would tell Joe that, you know, this kid needs to live in drier areas. It was big for him and for his health. So what they do is they move out at least for half a year, and they enroll Bill in a boarding school in Tucson, Arizona, which was very helpful. It fixed him up and he became healthy again. So this would be something where throughout Joe Bonanno's life, he was very much spending time in Florida. And Bill was watching his son really, watching his father run the family. He was running it from Arizona. He would go back to New York. And the problem that as Bill Bonanno gets older, he starts spending more time alone. He's there for months out of the year on his own. He starts getting involved with crime on his own. And Joe Bonanno has to come to the real point that, hey, my son, like many before me and many after me, wants to follow me into this life. And I think one thing I always say about Bill Bonanno, he was a loyal son, 100%. Was he cut out to be a mobster? I don't think. I think that was pretty clear. And that's generally how it goes. I mean, we look over the years at sons that have joined their fathers. They generally don't really hold the candle to the father, whether it's John Gotti, whether it's Sonny Vranzese, whether it's, Bill Cotolo, whether it's, whoever. Most of the time, these sons don't measure up, quite honestly. Now, by 1954, Bill Bonanno is very involved with the life. He decides that he wants to join, and he would actually be made that year. So 1954, he's pretty young. I mean, he's 22 years old, pretty much right around the time his father was made. He becomes a member of the Bonanno crime family. He would actually end up having a pretty incredible union. He would marry the niece of Profaci boss, Joe Profaci. What a pinnacle of prestige that was. And many actually would say that years later, this would actually be the inspiration, the wedding for the scene in The Godfather, actually. This was a swanky affair. Everyone from the likes of Magadino to Tony Accardo to Vita Genovese to Albert Anastasia were in attendance. And it was alleged that at the wedding party, the happy couple would earn about $750,000, which is a huge sum of money. And, you know, I think people that were close to Joe Bonanno or maybe were rivals of Joe Bonanno but came across as friends maybe realized at that point. And there's actually an interesting thing that was said at the wedding by Stefano Magadino, who had by this point really, I think, developed a bit of a hatred for his cousin. He felt like he was a little bit too big for his britches, maybe. He would say at the wedding that, quote, this is all going to Joe's head. Look at this. It's going to his head. Look at this wedding. By 1957, it's abundantly clear Joe Bonanno is one of the more powerful people on the face of the planet as far as the mob's concerned. He was very connected. He was still driven in and involved in Sicily. He had a lot of sway when it came to the commission, because by this point, remember, Lucky Luciano's in the wind. Carlo Gambino had not been established yet. Bill or Joe Bonanno at this point is the guy. Now, that year, he would actually head back to Sicily for the first time in a long time. And this is where, as we know, him and Carmen Galanti would develop the French connection in Sicily. And that would mean huge money for the mob and for the Bonanno crime family. Now, Joe Bonanno would say years later in an interview, there was 60 Minutes, that he had no idea that Carmen Galanti was selling narcotics. Which is completely laughable. I mean, the mob at that time was the principal leader of drug trafficking in this country. There's no fucking possible way Joe Bonanno didn't know they were selling narcotics. Look, they sold a lot of drugs. I mean, whether it was Carmen Galanti or John Armento or Joe Beck Di Palermo, I mean, they all sold a ton of drugs. And Carmen Galanti and Joe Bonanno were at really the pinnacle of that. As we know, though, in 1957, some things would really shake out. And this is really where things start to change for Joe Bonanno. I think people were kind of getting tired of Joe Bonanno. I think maybe they didn't respect him like I think he thought they respected him. And people were deciding to just do things behind his back. And that's pretty much what happened. Albert Anastasia's killed in October of 1957. And then they decide we're going to have a meeting. And Joe Bonanno actually wasn't invited to Apalachin. And look, it ended up being good for him because he didn't get arrested, at least at that surface. But, you know, they didn't really ask Joe for his opinion. He wasn't necessarily invited to Apalachin. And Joe's furious. You know, why wasn't he involved? They're going behind my back. This is supposed to be a commission. And, you know, I think this would set up some bad blood for Joe Bonanno towards people like Gambino and people like Tommy Lucchese. And look, once Apalachin happens, look, the FBI and the federal government knew who the mob were. But I think this is where we really start to see the mob not be a secret anymore, at least to the public. Right. You know, Apalachin was that front page paper type of thing where we kind of put everything on Front Street and say, here's all these guys in the middle of nowhere in upstate New York, and they all have their hats and their suits on, and this is what they do. They run this country. Joe would actually be arrested as well. He would claim at one point, quote, that he was an honest businessman. But the FBI is really starting to close in. And this is what really, I think, puts them on the forefront. The FBI is closing in. They're creating wiretaps. They're bugging people's places. And then in 1963, Joe Valachi happens. And this is incredibly bad for Joe Bonanno, because Joe Valachi actually names him in his testimony. He would say that Joe Bonanno was present the night he was made, which I don't know. I don't really understand this, because I don't know why he would be made, you know, then. But, you know, he was a member of the Lucchese family. Around those times, though, in 1930, there wasn't a commission yet. So I guess it is conceivable to think that Joe Bonanno could have been there. But Joe Bonanno is named by Joe Valachi as one of the individuals that was there the night he was made. Which wasn't good for Joe Bonanno. He continues to be named in things. Joe flees to Arizona completely, and he realizes that this might be the time for me to hang it up. I'm in my late 50s. I have all sorts of money. And look, this is kind of the problem with Joe Bonanno. He didn't have that maybe ruthless gene where he's like, no, fuck that. I'm not giving up. And in a way, maybe he was smart, because he realized that the writing was kind of on the wall, and he had all his money, and, you know, he could just pass off power and move on. What he does is he completely moves to Arizona and puts Bill in control. He claims that the capos wanted Bill as boss, but I think it was more of him just kind of, you know, foghorning his way in to saying, hey, Bill's going to be the boss and you're going to fucking like it. Now, there was a lot of people that would ostracize. And the one person that would ostracize most was his longtime friend, Gaspar Di Gregorio. Remember, Di Gregorio was a friend back from Sicily. He was the best man at Joe's wedding. He felt like he should be the guy in control. He was older. He was more established. Why are you going to let this young kid be in control? And a lot of people thought Bill Bonanno was what he was. He was, you know, kind of a playboy. You know, he always reminded me, Bill Bonanno, of Michael Francis a little bit. I never made the money that Michael did, but I feel like he was really similar. I felt like he probably should have went to school instead. Now, again, I won't take anything away from Michael. He made a lot of money, but I always felt like they were kind of similar. And the good thing for Di Gregorio was, you know, he kind of had people in his corner. Stefano Magadino was in his corner. And as we know, this was a great time for Magadino to really stick to his cousin. He starts manipulating Gaspar Di Gregorio. Uprising rumors start to swirl. And this is when the Joe Bonanno that is kind of ruthless comes out. The commission finds out and wants answers where they hear that, according to certain people, Joe Bonanno is attempting to kill Carla Gambino and Tommy Lucchese. Now, my thought always was that that was just rumors that Magadino created to kind of put Joe Bonanno in the meat cutter, if you will. I guess we'll never really know, but look, Magadino by this point hated his cousin. I think in a way may have been jealous of his cousin. I don't know. I mean, there was always some bad blood there, but I think a lot of this stuff was rumor and innuendo. He feels like this is a great time to kind of slot his guy Gaspar in, and he can now control the family. Joe's in the wind. And this is where this random story that he gets kidnapped comes up. Look, I don't believe he was kidnapped, but by now we have to remember Joe Bonanno is wanted by the commission. They want to speak to him. He's in the wind. The FBI wants to talk to him. He decides, supposedly, that he's kidnapped. He would claim that in October of 1964, he would be having dinner in New York, and he would leave with his lawyer, William Maloney. They would go to the home of Maloney at Park Avenue and 36th Street, where he's accosted by two men and thrown in the back of a car. Both of them had guns drawn on him. And he supposedly was kidnapped, and that he spent all this time with his cousin, and they basically held him for 18 months. And 18 months later, he would call Bill and say he was all right. And then he would just pop back up. A lot of people realize and believe this is probably bullshit. It was a smart move by Joe Bonanno because he avoided the mob and he avoided the feds for a long time. But eventually, he would have to come back. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that at one point, Gaspar De Gregorio decides, you know what, fuck Bill Bonanno. I'm going to make it like I'm going to have peace with him, but I'm actually going to try to kill him. So he would lure Bill to a home in Brooklyn, but Bill gets wind of it. And one thing I'll say about Bill Bonanno, he did escape this. He escaped a attempted hit on him, basically, which was pretty stealthy in his own mind. But this would really kind of force Joe Bonanno to come out of hiding. He's got to face the music. He's got to go face the mob. He's got to go face the FBI. And he has to turn in front of the government. So he does what he has to do. He comes back with a vengeance, though, in the eyes of the mob, and kind of quote says, this is his family. He's not going away anymore. He's not going to back down. Now, he would go back and forth with De Gregorio, with emissaries, and try to take over. And this would actually start a bit of a war, if you will, and they'd call it the Banana War, as we know. A couple individuals were actually shot that were part of the kind of the, not the upper echelon, but they were capo regimes in the Bonanno family. An individual named Vincent Garofalo was shot. Also an individual, Vincent Cashish, was shot as well. And Joe Bonanno needed to hit back. And Bill Bonanno would claim years later that they decided they needed to hit the other side hard. In November of 1967, three individuals are at a restaurant in Brooklyn, Tommy, and Jimmy D'Angelo, and an individual called Frankie 500 Talleri. They're all sitting in a restaurant in, I believe, Queens or Brooklyn, and a gunman runs in and sprays the restaurant and kills all three of them. And this was a pretty brazen hit, actually. And, you know, there were a bunch of restaurant diners in there at the time. And, you know, look, this is something that Joe Bonanno, I guess, felt he needed to do. They needed to hit back. Eventually, De Gregorio would actually get the picture and actually just kind of turn away. He decides he doesn't want anything to do with it, kind of gets the picture. But for Joe Bonanno, it really didn't matter. The running was on the wall. At the end of the day, when the mob wants you out, you're going to go. And that's exactly what they did. By the end of the 60s, Joe Bonanno flees. He leaves New York and completely retires to Arizona. At this point, the mob decides Joe Bonanno is going to be shelved. He just doesn't know it yet. The individual that actually would spray that restaurant up would actually be alleged to be an individual called Gaspar Magadino. he would actually be killed several years later at his home on 2462 East 2nd Street in Brooklyn. The name Magadina obviously rings true. This was actually a family member of Stefano Magadina. They were all cousins with Joe, and he would actually switch allegiance and get into Joe Bonanno's camp. He was actually the one that would do this hit, and he would actually turn up dead. So things were really starting to go haywire for Joe Bonanno. Now, Bonanno is in Arizona. He's held up out there with his son. Joe would live in an area of Tucson called Catalina Vista. And Bill actually started to do some things of his own. He would actually plant the flag of the mob really in all sorts of different areas. He would turn up in Arizona, obviously. He would turn up in California. I know at one point he actually had a meeting up in Yakima, Washington with an individual called Frank Colacursio. Now, I want to kind of go off on a tangent just a little bit here. I did a video on our YouTube channel about Frank Colacursio. I've had questions to me. Hey, Jeff, can you talk about, is there mobs in some of these smaller areas? And Frank Colacursio was a guy that really ran the nightclub industry in Seattle for decades. He was an Italian guy from Sicily. He had a lot of roots. He was connected. He had a group of people that were under him. It was not a mafia. Now, at one point, he would actually meet up with Bill Bonanno. And according to Colacursio, he would say years later that nothing would ever happen. He kind of told Bill Bonanno to get lost. You're not going to come in here and kind of screw with what we got going on here. Now, they were not a mafia. It's important to understand. There was no mafia family there. They were really just a group of Italians that had, kind of territory up in Seattle. But there was no mafia family in Seattle. So Bill was kind of planting his flag everywhere. But in 1970, he was actually convicted on 52 counts of mail fraud and sentenced to 4 years in prison after he and a brother of his, Joe Jr., were actually involved in a scheme in Northern California with a car dealer called Lou Peters. They were kind of muscling in, trying to extort this guy. They wanted to buy him out. He didn't want to do it. They started threatening him. He had different dealers all up and down Northern California, Lodi, Stockton, San Jose, Oakland, all these different areas. So Lou Peters decides, you know what? These Italians coming out here, they're not going to shake me down. I'm going to go to the FBI. He goes to the FBI and Bill and his brother Joe are hemmed up in this. So yeah, they're really kind of all over the place. Joe Bonanno is like in hiding, basically. He's shelved by this point. And Bill's decided, you know what? I'm a reject. I'm not accepted in New York. I'm going to try to plant my flag out in California and Arizona and Washington. And it never worked. Like, no one really respected Bill Bonanno at the end of the day. Like, look at the Seattle situation. Frank Colacursio basically said in a roundabout way, hey, go fuck yourself. Now, in 1981, Bill Bonanno was actually indicted again in Oakland, California, on 21 counts of grand theft for defrauding senior citizens for home improvements that were never completed. So Bill Bonanno was really becoming a bit of a scumbag, quite honestly. Trial would be postponed multiple times. And he would ultimately be sentenced to 4 years in prison in 1986. Now, I want to kind of circle back on Joe Bonanno because we haven't gotten to the real, like, pathetic part of Joe Bonanno's life. Look, up until 1960, I think Joe Bonanno was super respectable. I think at one point in the late 50s, he was probably the most powerful person in the country as far as the mob was concerned. But Joe Bonanno really started to kind of come undone. I mean, he never really had that ruthless instinct. He was like, obviously a man of honor and super respected and all this kind of stuff. In 1983, we remember he's in his late 70s. Maybe he's a little nuts or bots, if you will. He decides, I'm going to write a book. Yes, you heard that right. Joe Bonanno, a boss of a family who went back to the 20s, decides, hey, I'm going to become a writer. I'm going to publish my book, and I'm going to start appearing in TV things. He would write a book titled A Man of Honor, The Autobiography of Joseph Bonanno. And that would appear on shelves in 1983. He would then subsequently decide as well he was going to go on 60 Minutes and talk about his life. And this is where he started in on really everything. And this was a huge issue for the mafia. because Joe Bonanno is not snitching per se, but he's starting to let out the secrets. This is a guy that called himself the most respected man in New York. He would also say that, quote, he is the last survivor of something extinct in this country. And what he means by that is he is the last known actual mafia member. All these new guys are fucking frauds, basically, and they can't stack up the big bad Joe Bonanno. And this was bad for Joe Bonanno because, as we know, in the early to mid 80s, there's an individual, a young prosecutor called Rudolph Giuliani, that just needs a bit of artillery to fight the war of against the mafia. And this stuff did pretty big things to the mob. I mean, a lot of people were hemmed up due to this behavior by Joe Bonanno. He pretty much did everything. And what do we know about Omerta? You do never admit you were part of it. And that's that. I don't know where else Joe Bonanno would feel like this was anything right. Now, the editor for Man of Honor, Michael Korda, would say of Bonanno, in a world where most of the players were at best semi-illiterate, Bonanno read poetry, boasted of his knowledge of classics, and gave advice to his cohorts in the forms of Machiavelli. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to paint Joe Bonanno as this, like, you know, scholarly legend who can read, and he has all these poems, and he's this educated guy. And look, I'll be honest. I mean, it is quite incredible that he went from being, you know, just a street guy to the boss of a family in a couple of years. But you know, at the end of the day, this did major things to the mob at the end of the day. Giuliani would actually go to Arizona at one point and wanted to talk to Joe Bonanno. But weirdly enough, Joe Bonanno decides he doesn't want to talk. So even though he writes a book literally on the life of his mafia crimes, he decides he doesn't want to talk. He would ultimately get a prison sentence for contempt of court and obstruction and serve 1.5 years. That would be the only prison sentence Joe Bonanno would have. He would be in the mob for about 50 years and would only go to prison for about 1.5 years. As I said, the book would crush organized crime as we know it. Now, Joe Bonanno actually died in May of 2002 at the age of 1997. He would live his life really in relative anonymity till the end. He would die of heart failure. No one really ever came back on Joe Bonanno. Obviously, what were they going to do? You know, by the late 90s, the mob was a shell of what it once was, and no one was going to do anything. Now, Bill Bonanno would actually write a book as well. He would write a crime book called Honor Thy Father as well. Bill Bonanno actually would die, though, in 2008, and he is no longer with us as well. So really, Joe Valachi and Joe Bonanno, I think, really were the biggest death nails to the mob, really, ever. And we would ultimately see years later, boss of the Bonanno crime family, Joey Messino, do something that no mobster ever did. This was the problem with the Bonanno family. Really, since their inception, they always had faulty leaders. And, you know, this is why when you hear me talk about Joe Messino, like, as a boss, I thought Joe Messino was an incredibly good boss. I think really the only good boss they ever had. Now, remember, Joe Bonanno was a good boss at one point, but it really wasn't long. And he was, at the end of the day, just not ruthless enough, and, you know, ultimately just ran with his tail between his legs and ran to Arizona, which would he would do a lot. He didn't put the right people in control. Now, after the reign of Joe Bonanno, an individual called Paul Sciacca would actually become the boss in 1968. He would actually be succeeded by an individual called Natale Avoli. Sciacca actually would be indicted for selling heroin and would go to jail, but he would die in 1986. So that's the problem with the Bonanno family. Really, since, you know, the inception, they never had a leader that, you know, outside of Joe Bonanno was really there for very long. And that's why Joe Messino, I think, really kind of changed the structure then, because he was a boss that was there for a while and he incorporated all sorts of things and whatnot. But yeah, Joe Bonanno, I've always said, not as interesting, I think, as a lot of other guys. Obviously, his taking over the family so early, you know, was incredible. And he definitely did some good things. He made a lot of money. But He never really was that powerful. I don't think anyone truly really ever respected him at the end of the day. I think he's pretty overrated, quite honestly, as a boss. And look, writing the book was obviously a huge problem. There's something you just don't do in the mob, and that's admit that you're part of it. And then he just did like weird things. Like he wouldn't testify. It's like, well, you literally told every secret possible and now, and you went on 60 Minutes and now you don't want to say anything. But you know, an interesting individual nonetheless. Joe Bonanno on the sit down. These shows go quick, very simple, very easy. I feel like we can concentrate on the conversation. We get in, we get out, we give you a fun little biography each week. We have a great time doing it. I know people are enjoying the show. I get so many great messages about it. We just crossed 500,000 listeners for the calendar year, just 4 months, really. So it's been actually not even 4 months, three months and about 12 days. So it's been a great ride. I love doing this show. I love getting involved. I do expect the show to elevate soon. I'm in the works on some things. I've definitely presented the show to some people. I think it needs to be scaled. We need to talk to more people. We need to have bigger episodes. But again, I mean, this show is so simple. It's so easy to do. And it's a great time. As always, make sure you follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Like I said, if you enjoy mob content, you want more of it, go check us out on YouTube. Just type in the Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. What we're going to do next week, and I'm going to tell you guys now, we're going to do some Anthony Mira stuff. I think I'm going to do Anthony Mira next week. But also what we're going to do, we're going to do a Q&A. And I like to do a Q&A every once in a while. We haven't done one in a while. So here's what I'll do. I'll obviously put a post out on Twitter at some point. But if you're listening to the show, you want to send in a question, do me a favor and DM the Sit Down at the Sit Down 7 on Twitter. I'll make sure we get your question in the rotation. I want to make sure we kind of address your concerns. I know a lot of people have questions on the mafia, and I like to involve the listeners. What I also will do is if you don't want to listen to the Q&A, I'll just make sure I put the point of where we start talking about Anthony Mira, and we'll make sure we put that in. So, yeah, send me your questions on Twitter DM. Please don't send them to me on a post. Send them to me in a DM so I have them all in one spot. So that'll be fun. We'll look forward to that next week. We'll do a little Anthony Mira and a little Q&A as well. I am Jeff Nadeau. Thanks as always for listening. I do appreciate it, folks. Thank you for all the kind words. Thank you for being here every week. And thank you for subscribing. The good thing about the show is you can watch or listen to any of the shows and you don't have to watch them in order. So, but it is nice seeing like new people listen to the Gigante show, the first one we ever did, because that means people, you know, are listening and starting the show over. So, or seeing us for the first time. So thanks for being here. Hope you enjoyed it. Joe Bonanno. Everyone have a great night. We'll see you next week here on the Sit Down. Have a great week.